in Little Rock where I lived, you were cool if you were on food stamps. That was cool. And so you are who you're around. So it's really hard to be pulled out of that. I had so much help. Yeah. And then when I went to Belgium, I was like, this is how people live. This is how they grow up. They have a beautiful home and they have their own room and they have people that cook dinner with them. And then they want to talk about homework. Success has to seem tangible. So like, I think for a lot of young kids and even people that reach out to me through social media and stuff, when I post about my childhood, what's so hard is you can't expect someone to pick up a book that's never really had a family, never been around anyone that has any form of success. There was a tweet someone put out that was like, you know, all the best founders I know are most successful people, like read all the time and all of that. And I'm like, that is such a luxury. I just worked my butt off, but I learned how different companies work. And I was like also running a boutique for a woman in New Paltz when I was in college. So like I learned how you go to trade shows and like procure stuff for the stores and the markups on jewelry and clothes and that kind of stuff. And then marketing. And then at the bakery also. So that was a grueling job.
Really?
It's grueling. You're next to an oven.
You're baking, right?
Yeah. Literally, okay. Yeah. I was making challah bread for the French toast at the bistro that's downtown. There's only one. It's a line out of the door on the weekends with college students. And then in the evening and weekends, I worked for a legitimate pastry chef who made wedding cakes and things like that. I was her assistant. And so I just did everything. Like I worked at the gym, like the front desk. Like I was like, whatever job I need to work to make money. One was like $8 an hour. The other was $10 an hour. And I just tried to work as much as I could. The school's a little, not that anyone's watching, but like I wasn't always like vocal about it because they say you're not supposed to work, I think, more than like 8 or 10 hours a week if you're a college student. I couldn't do that. So yeah. I was consistently like just doing whatever I could.
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nana Capital, your favorite founder's favorite venture capital firm. Today, I'm excited to share my conversation with Nicole Wischoff, the founder of Wischoff Ventures, one of the bluest of blue chip emerging pre-seed and seed funds. Nicole has an incredible story, and we'll talk about growing up on food stamps in Little Rock, Arkansas, how most of her siblings' first jobs were illegal, why studying abroad in Belgium changed her life, opening a bakery to pay rent while teaching English in Spain, how falling in love with running got her into college and her first job, and what she learned working multiple jobs throughout college as a full-time student athlete. Nicole recently closed her second $20 million fund, and we'll talk about getting her first job in San Francisco in Citi's nonprofit housing finance team, leveraging that experience to jump into a fintech startup, making her first angel investment in Vesta, the crazy story behind getting One Financial its first 25,000 users, how she helped sell One to Walmart, how Lee Fixel and Chad Byers helped raise her first $5 million fund, all the lessons learned raising her second $20 million fund in 2022. And finally, behind the scenes of her viral third-tier VC moment earlier in 2023. Thank you so much, Nicole, for taking the time to sit down with me. If you're looking for candid and actionable advice from someone with a non-traditional path on breaking into tech and starting your own venture firm, I think you'll love this conversation. Let's jump in after a quick word from SecureFrame. We're about to hear how hard Nicole worked throughout her life to get to where she is. And if she was starting a company, not a fund, the last thing she would have had time for is thinking about things like compliance, security, and privacy. But that's where SecureFrame comes in. Longtime listeners already know SecureFrame is the automated compliance platform built by security experts. Thousands of your favorite startups like Angelus, Coda, and Ram use SecureFrame to get, stay, and automate their compliance with security and privacy frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, GDPR, and many more. If you've ever tried getting compliant in any of these, you already know how hard and time-consuming it is. SecureFrame's new tool, Comply AI, streamlines all your compliance, which gives you more time to focus on actually growing your business. I'm an investor in SecureFrame, and I recommend it to every founder I meet. Join hundreds of other listeners of The Peel, and click the link in the show notes to get started on a demo with SecureFrame's in-house team of compliance experts and former auditors. Thank you, SecureFrame. And now, let's talk to Nicole Wischoff.
Nicole, how's it going?
It's going awesome. Crazy to be here with you in New York.
I thought a good way to start it off, you had this tweet, I forget when you tweeted it, but it was a picture of a house and you said, this is the house I grew up in. Can you explain background of the house?
Yes. So I believe that was around my birthday. I turned 33 in August. And I think in the world that we're in, you know, while I've transitioned to starting my own firm and raising a few funds, it still feels, and it's easy when you live on X, you know, all the time or your online period, but it's easy to feel like you're so damn far behind. And so, you know, I was having a moment, I was talking to my little sister and she's like, wait, hang on. What? Like, you don't get to be sad ever about, you know, your accomplishments or where you are. And she sent me the Zillow of where we grew up. And so I had posted a screenshot of the house that I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, with all of my siblings and my dad and his girlfriend. My parents got divorced when I was 10. They filed for bankruptcy. We were very, very poor. And so he moved into that house. And I think he had bought it for maybe $60,000 or maybe even $40,000 in the 90s or early 2000s. Yeah. And so I think back on, you know, how hard that was in that neighborhood. And I'm like, wait, holy crap. It's easy to sort of black out the memories. Like, I think for a long time, and we can certainly get into it, I don't think that I had a single like happy childhood memory, which is really sad, until I was probably like 15. I forget all of that. I think, you know, my therapist would say that like I'm a survivor. That's actually like a term, and it's a part of what comes out of trauma. I am very much always look forward, never look back. So like, where do we go next? How do we do better? How do we improve? That's just always been my mindset. So I'm not someone who lives back there and thinks like, that was so hard. I'm stunted. I have, you know, issues because my parents weren't always there. So yeah, there were, you know, 7 kids and maybe 1,000 square feet. We were in the ghetto of Little Rock. I was one of 10 white people of 1,200 middle school students. There were bodyguards at our school. There was gang violence. Kids had guns. These are 11, 12-year-old kids. So like on the bus, I had to stand. I was bullied. Like I was like, again, one of very few white people in our neighborhood. And so again, easy to forget all of that, but it was a moment of reflection of like, wait, hang on. We are in such a different, very privileged world compared to that. Like if this is ever as far as I go, I've made it. And so that's why I posted the tweet.
So when we first met, I think it was about 2 years ago, one of the things that really stood out to me, obviously that story, that part of it, but also you said, I think you had multiple siblings who their first job was not necessarily legal. Can you kind of talk about that and what you learned?
So when my parents got divorced, we literally had nothing. And my oldest siblings were old enough. I forget the rules in Arkansas, but I think you had to be 12 or 13 to choose which parent you wanted to go with when your parents get divorced. And so the oldest three went to live with my dad, and then he went back active in the Navy. So he went on a ship for 7 months and was gone. So they were in that house that I posted alone, and they were between, I think, 13 and 17. And so all of them dropped out of high school. You know, something that people ask a lot, either foundations when they talk to me, some people that know about my childhood are like, well, how do we help? How do we find kids like you and pull them out of these places? So much of this, I think, is parenting. You know, when the parents disappear and no one like holds you accountable or cares about you, you get into a lot of trouble. So our neighbors got into a lot of trouble. They would steal, they would sell drugs. And so my siblings weren't the ones going to get the food stamps, and we didn't have parents around. And so my brother was breaking into cars and stealing amps and CD cases and then like reselling them essentially. So like, I remember he would come home and just throw CD cases at me, and I would listen to like Tupac CDs and like D12 Eminem, if anyone like used to listen to that. And like, I grew up on that, and also had no idea that what they were doing was, I knew obviously it was bad, but like I was 10 and they were, you know, almost old enough to be arrested, not juvie. And then they, you know, we don't have to go too deep here, but like the first thing I learned how to do was steal. You know, my brothers would be like, go do it. You're the young one. No one will think it's suspicious. It would be little stuff at Walmart, or it would be like and I had no idea, you know, like I'm just a kid, and I felt like I was like their mule. I was, you know, but I learned they were making money. I mean, they were putting groceries in the house, but that was a lot of probably more of the informative years of my early life, where the benefit of this is that from a super young age, I've just always had to think for myself. Like no one cooked meals for me. No one did my laundry. So I was learning how to, I guess, be a parent to myself, which I think translates well to maybe starting a business, which we can get into because you have to figure it out. But, you know, I was seeing a lot of like what can go wrong or what you don't do from a lot of the implications of that. But that was like that was a big part of my young life.
And you mentioned too, you actually stayed with some teachers at school in some cases. I mean, was that a big part of that helping you get through all of that?
I had no idea how bad it was. Also, I was very skinny. And so I remember a lot of my classmates like talking about that, like how they could see like, you know, my collarbones like really well, or like the veins, like we were just malnourished kids. And I definitely was. And I think it was more obvious because I got tall fast. And so anyway, I remember after school, a lot of my favorite memories were my school teachers, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th grade. And I didn't connect the dots until I was older, but a lot of them would bring me home with them after school. So I stayed at my teachers' houses a lot. What I didn't realize is that they were taking turn making sure that I was showered and fed. I just thought it was fun. You know, they had kids I got to hang out with. I'd sleep like, you know, in an extra room or something like that. And I think a lot of it was just looking out for me, which I realize now.
Everything I know about teachers and how hard it is to be a teacher, it was probably not easy for them either.
No. And I've always been extremely curious. So I think I was like a teacher's favorite because I always wanted to learn and I always wanted to be involved. And that's been the case since as far back as I can remember. I wanted to read so bad before I could read, you know, like I was jealous of people that picked up books and were like, could tell you what they learned. And so maybe that was a part of it too. Like they really saw something in me and probably a struggling little girl.
Was there anything that helped you get through that? Was it the curiosity and just, you just wanted to learn things and you wanted to better yourself?
Everyone's always like, how did you get out? Because I'm like the second to go to college and finish college and the second to even finish high school. And like my parents never went to college or anything. I certainly think curiosity has led the charge. I also really like to work. I like to do things. And so that has been helpful. I think I was definitely the nerd of the family. So there are seven of us. I'm number five. And at number five, my dad, I guess, said to my mom, like, we should have number six. We should even it out so everyone has a buddy, which I think does help. But then they had twins. So I was five and then they had twins. And then my mom was like, I'm totally done. Like, we're not, you know, doing this anymore.
So the twins buddied up and
they're besties.
Oh, man.
I was definitely the loner.
Okay.
Like, I remember, I actually don't even know if this is true, but I remember coming home and telling, we had this old Suburban that we all fit into. And I remember being in the car on the way home from school. And I was like, couldn't wait to tell everyone what I learned, which was that King Tut died from a toothache and that you could die from like toothaches. You know. And I don't even know if this is true, but I remember this. And my brother was like, you're such a loser. You know, like they just really were hard on me. Like they thought that because
you're
I like school.
Yeah.
So my own siblings, like I was the outcast at home. And so I think that was another thing maybe my teachers picked up on. Everyone had a buddy except me. And so I was like, you know, just became someone that teachers and other kind of outside the family people kind of took me under their wing.
And now you're a solo GP.
And now I'm alone.
Yeah.
Still alone. Yes. What's crazy is I love people. I just really like to get shit done. And I find that in big groups or with big companies and big teams, all of that slows to like a grinding halt, which is why, you know, I didn't want to do a startup actually. And we can get into some of that. But I just think that being small and you can move fast and be agile and like get shit done.
You probably had a lot of help or pushes getting into college. Like how did that whole process go for you in terms of just going from the house, no family had ever gone to college, getting in, going, how did that work?
Yeah, this probably is not surprising, but the education that I had in Little Rock was terrible. And so, and the school I was going to, I mean, the school was so bad, we didn't have windows in classrooms because of the violence. And we like, we didn't have homework because no one would do it. And like, there were no sports because people would fight. So like so I did not have a good education. And so my mom ended up remarrying someone upstate New York. We had moved back there, her with my youngest siblings. And so I ended up leaving Little Rock and going to upstate New York, which is very valuable. So she married an amazing man, my stepdad, Bernie, who I would not be here without. Middle income, but stable, helped pay off a lot of her debt and like really kind of like bring us in and put us into a good school. And so that was also hard because I was 12 or 13 at that point. And in middle school, and I'm entering, or is that high school, maybe ninth grade?
Seventh or eighth grade.
Okay. And so I end up in Cooperstown, New York, in a very rich town. It's the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I have a heavy Southern accent with my siblings. I can't spell drawer. I thought exactly was spelled
with
like an S.
Were you pretty behind on all
extremely
that
stuff? Behind. Hmm. So I ended up essentially failing in math and science. And then I think in ninth grade, I had to double up. I had to have a ton of tutoring. So I was very, very far behind. And 11th grade, I think the biggest, more pivotal moment of my life is when I studied abroad. But, you know, my mom meeting my stepdad, getting us into a much better school for a much better opportunity was really important. And a culture shock. You know, we were like white trash, for better or worse, like compared to our classmates. We didn't have a lot. I didn't have a new outfit every day. But I had an opportunity. And so I took it and I wanted to obviously stay there. My siblings hated it. They were like, these New Yorkers, East Coasters are so mean. You know, like they're like, we don't understand what they're saying. Their vocabulary is so big. Like, and so it was really, it was culture shock. So they actually moved back down with my dad, who wasn't there, but most of them didn't stay. So me and the twins, Trent and Tracy, stayed in Cooperstown. And I did the best I could. I doubled up. And then in 11th grade, I had met an exchange student from Belgium and she was studying abroad in Cooperstown. And I was like, that is so cool.
You probably didn't even know that was a thing.
No, I'm like, where is Belgium? You know, like, is that in Germany? Like, I remember my brother asking me that. And I was like, that's a good question. That's how bad, like uneducated, you know, we were. And so I end up applying through Rotary. Rotary is an amazing exchange program.
Is this Rotary International? Or
yes.
Is it, okay.
But they have like, so anywhere you go, even in New York, there's always like a club or, you know, so there's always like a cohort. They do Tuesday lunches once a month. It's like an amazing philanthropic business. And so they essentially, if you get in, they place you in a country with a host family. You typically switch families every 3 months. So you have like three, it's about 9 months. And then they pay for everything except airfare. So if you can get there and get home, then the host family has to support you and feed you, put you in school and things like that. So it's an incredible program.
And is this specifically targeted at a kind of like underprivileged?
No. A big thing when they're interviewing you is terrifying. They were all in suits and it was like very serious. It was like a board meeting.
Did you have to dress up for it?
Yes. Okay. And I was 16 and a half.
16, yeah.
So and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I barely fit in this town and now I'm trying to do this thing. And a lot of my friends were like, just don't be discouraged if you don't get in kind of thing. And my high school counselor told me that if I studied abroad in Belgium, that I would have to do another year of high school, 5 years, because I wouldn't have the credits to go to a 4-year college.
Jeez.
And so he was like, you're going to add another year. And I was like, it's worth it. And so I ended up applying. They ask you to list your top 5 countries. I wanted to go to Belgium for whatever reason.
Did you just do Belgium, Belgium, Belgium?
It was like,
all the way down?
Yeah, Belgium, Brazil. Like, I don't even know.
To start with B.
It was just like every, I was like, where are these places? So I ended up getting in and that completely changed my life. Like I would have never gone to college. And I say that because, so I went there and I stayed with a host family. From the second day that I was with them, they asked if I'd stay the whole year because they're not as open as Americans. Like we like to host kids and the culture of like hosting internationals is like more open. In Belgium, at least, they're very private. And so it feels very invasive to have a random 17-year-old kid in your house. So they did it because they were basically required to do it. Their son went to Canada, and so they had to take someone in. And so they brought me in, and they are the most amazing people ever. And they ran a tight ship. So
a tight ship.
I had never had discipline in my life. I never cooked meals with my family. We never did stuff together. You know, I never went to an art class. Like we didn't have things on the weekends. And I got all of that with them. My host parents were just very involved. We cooked meals together, grocery shop. Like I had a ton of structure. My host mom was like, you know, adamant about like organizing the dishwasher a certain way, like being really tidy and you don't leave your jacket on the back of your dinner table and like all those kind of things.
And this was just like a new concept. Like you didn't even realize this was a thing.
I cried every day for 2 months. I was like, this sucks. I thought like when you're an exchange student, you like got to have fun. Like they're so strict.
But they wanted you to stay with them from day two.
Yeah.
But you were having a terrible time?
Before I realized that how strict they were, you know, I had said yes. In hindsight, it was actually awesome because they had 2 boys. They had never had a girl and they were terrified. I'm under 18 and we're in a city. I'd never really lived in a city. And so it was like, if you're biking everywhere and the drinking age is 16, so we were out, they were really worried, like someone can kidnap me, like anything can happen. Like I just more sensitive to me being out and about and not them not knowing where I was. Also, we didn't have mobile iPhones. So like, it was not like we could be in touch. I had a prepaid phone that I couldn't afford minutes on. So like, they didn't know how to contact me. So I understand now looking back, you know, like that they're, but then I remember after a few months in, the curfew went away and they'd start to say like, we build trust, like come back when you think it's time to come back, you know, from being out and all those kind of things. And I love being with them. We go to museums. They're amazing interior architects. Learned a lot about architecture, learned obviously to speak Dutch through them, and just felt like I had parents, you know, for the first time that could like support you and do the extra stuff. I was in an art school on Saturdays and I was so eager when I got back to the States. I had another year of high school, so 5 years. I'm like the oldest person in high school. It's like weird. I took every AP class. I wanted to learn everything I could. And all I wanted to do is go to a 4-year school. The only reason I got into SUNY New Paltz, so I went to a state school here in New York.
Yep. What is that? SUNY New, what is it?
So it's the SUNYs are the state universities of New York, similar to like the UCs. Like I ended up getting in to, I'd say one that was like in the top three. And the only reason I got in, because I didn't have the grades and like my SAT scores and all that weren't great, I ended up getting in because of running. So I had started running with my host mom. I was mostly afraid of her, so I'd say yes if she asked me to run. So I would like, we started at 2 miles. She'd run me around the block. And I remember thinking, I'm going to die here. This is like,
were
this
you still
is
like
death.
Pretty skinny?
I was, but like, he doesn't translate to like intense cardio.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I was light, but I wasn't like, I've always been a smaller person, but it was not great. And so she was 55 and crushed me, super fit. So she'd run me for like 22 minutes, which was 2 miles, and then drop me on the doorstep. And I remember being like, I can't do this. Like, I'm not, you know. But then what's great, so I kept doing it with her. And then by the time I left, you can, your body can pick up running pretty quickly if you're consistent.
Yep.
I was doing 12-mile runs with her on the beaches over in Holland. So like we go over to like the Netherlands and like run. It was not far.
Was that good setting to run on the beach in the Netherlands?
Yes. Not for the whole run. Those would be like 12-mile runs. So we would do like five of it and then like run. We'd run from Bell. Like it would be, we'd drive out some portion of the way. And then she had a group of older women she ran with that did ultras and stuff. Like they were hardcore. Mm. And I would just hang on for dear life. But so then she hugged me at the airport. And she said, I know you'll never do this run again, but thank you for spending a year like doing it with me. And then I get back to Cooperstown and I'm running still because I love it. Like I'm like, I've gotten used to this. I can go for 5-mile runs. And I remember the cross country coach seeing me and she's like, you haven't used any of your years of sports. Like, you know, would you want to do your final senior year running? And apparently I was like pretty good at it. So like I went to States like my first year and then the coach in New Paltz found me and was like, you were in the top 10 at States and I've never heard of you. Like it's your senior year. Like, do you want to come? So he got me in as like a special talent because my grades weren't there and then got into college because of that.
Wow.
So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Kind of pieced together.
Yeah. So going to Belgium definitely changed your life.
Yes, in every way possible. I think it's really important for kids. What's really hard is success has to seem tangible. So like, I think for a lot of young kids and even people that reach out to me through social media and stuff, when I post about my childhood, what's so hard is you can't expect someone to pick up a book that's never really had a family, never been around anyone that has any form of success. By the way, like in Little Rock where I lived, you were cool if you were on food stamps. That was cool. And so like living off the, you know what I mean? It was like this like cool thing. And so you are who you're around. So it's really hard to sort of on your own be pulled out of that. I had so much help. Yeah. And then when I went to Belgium, I was like, this is how people live. This is how they grow up. They have a beautiful home and they have their own room and they have people that cook dinner with them. And then they want to talk about homework. And my host said, like when I lead, he thinks I'm going to be like the first like female president of the United States. He like thinks the world of me. And I'm like, take it easy. He's awesome. But
I
don't,
honestly, I think Taylor Swift might be, if I had to pick someone, a Taylor Swift Beyonce ticket.
I'll
I think
take Travis Kelce is like the first man.
The first man.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, that. I mean, this is a total sidebar, but that is an insane combination. Just like all the things they bring to the table and like who they are. That's like the new power couple.
I love it.
It's like America's power couple.
I think it's really easy on either side for someone to be really intimidated by the success of the other person. And in this case, they seem super secure, have their shit together clearly. I'm like, let's go. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. I was actually talking about this with my wife. We were trying to figure out why has she had so many relationship things like what? And it feels like it's maybe not her. Right? We thought it's like, she's just so successful and it's like hard for some guys to date someone that's more successful than you.
I think we all also keep in mind, she's just like a human. You know, I think we all, is she 30, early 30s maybe?
Maybe she's probably like our age, 32, 34, something like that.
And if you think about it, like, I think maybe you're more fortunate here, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you meet someone early on in your life you want to be with forever, that's awesome. But like, you know, I had maybe a couple of relationships for 3 years each, hers maybe a little bit longer, but I think sometimes it also just, and maybe it's also because I'm super career driven, but you kind of learn a lot about, I think there's just, they say like your partner grows with you or grows up with you. And if they don't, it's not a fit. And so I think at certain points, like some people maybe don't want to be along for that ride anymore, or they want a different one. And I see that a lot, even when, with my own friends, they're like, wait, I do want kids. And the other one's like, I don't, it's not happening.
I think a lot of it is you evolve together. You make compromises. Like that's not a good way to phrase it, but like you learn to love the things about the people and you almost learn like new things about yourself that you maybe enjoy now, like running.
Yeah.
Like you might get really into something with your partner that you're like, I like this now. Like I like spending time with you and I feel like we gel well together.
No, exactly. I think that takes time and that's okay. And then if you can write albums about it and make money and be a superstar, then like, why not?
Yeah. And she's very, very smart. There's an episode from Acquired, the podcast, which is called Taylor Swift Acquired, if you search it.
Oh, I haven't.
It's very good. They do like a 2-hour entire career life story.
Wow.
All the strategy behind all the moves that she made. You'll listen to me like, holy shit, she's amazing.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it to you and then also everybody listening.
That's awesome.
So then getting into college, how did that go?
I was obviously really excited. Like I remember even when I was applying for schools, we didn't have the money. Like even though my mom married my stepdad, we were still couldn't spend a lot. And so I had a few jobs already in high school. And so I would like open up a coffee shop in Cooperstown in the morning and like say hey to the locals and then I'd go to school. And then sometimes I would come back and close it. So like school would let out around 3:30 or something. And then I would go close it at 6, like for 2 hours.
Were you able to sort of minimize student loans? through working? Or
so, that's a good question. So, well, that part was even to afford to pay for the application to apply for college. So there were four schools I wanted to apply to, and they were $40 or $50.
It costs, that's a lot of money.
It's like a lot of money. Yeah, and so we didn't have it. And so I was like, shoot, I got to, my mom, I do appreciate that she was always like, well, then you got to go to work. You know, you're over 16. Like, you got to go to work. So I remember working, and like my tips and stuff would go towards my applications. And then, of course, New Paltz worked out. So when I got there, I felt so indebted to my coach for getting me in. He had one special talent on combined between men's and women's teams.
And he coached both. That, like,
and he used
bullet.
It on me.
Yeah.
And so I ran my ass off. Like, I was like, I am going to break every record at this school, and I am going to go to the NCAAs. No one has ever done that. And I fucking did it, which is crazier. So I and now there's been a few girls that have, like, obviously have been faster than me since I graduated, but I actually don't know if anyone's gone to the NCAAs since I did, and no one on the men's team ever had. And so I felt so, so indebted to him. I ran 80 miles a week and was like, I'll do whatever it takes to return the favor. And I love school. So actually, like, my GPA wasn't terrible. Like, I was like doing political science and Asian studies, double major. And then I had three jobs. So I did everything. I ran 10 miles a day. I was baking in the basement of a bakery in college at 4 o'clock in the morning. We can get into that. I worked my butt off.
Right, to make money.
That was insane. This was post. This was a good life skill just to have. When I graduated, I'd followed a boyfriend over to Spain to teach English, and it was a little bit of a disaster. He's awesome. Really? But the whole, I want to make sure we cover the college bases, but ran my life away, was super dedicated to that. And like, loved all of my classes. I wouldn't say it translated to where I am now. I don't know that, like, I think college is awesome. I loved it, but I was mostly like a professional runner in college, you know, like, it didn't tee me up for any type of career.
You learned how to be organized and like take things seriously. Like, I guess I learned how to do laundry in a class. I'd never done my own laundry, right? Like, I learned how to go to bed at a decent time, right? You get forced into, there's no parents.
Yeah.
And you're like, you mess up, and then you realize, oh shit, like, I got to get my life together if I want to figure this all out. That's a big thing I went through. It's just like, how do you be a functioning adult in society?
Well, it was like, you're paying rent. So like, I had student loans for that. My stepdad tried to help a little bit. And then I don't have a relationship with my dad, but for 2 years of school, he had a GI Bill from the Navy that he never used. So it paid for 2 years. So I had to pay off. Tough. Also, it was $18,000 a year as a state school. So it wasn't crazy, which helps like a lot. So I think I paid off all of my student loans probably 5 years ago.
I'm probably about the same.
Yeah.
I did the same. I think the peak, I did 18 credits and 40 hours a week. Insane. But
that's crazy.
I had no debt that year. Like, no new student loans, which is good in retrospect. I think you learn a lot too. Just working, like you said, three jobs. Like, you have to prioritize. You learn how to be efficient. You learn how to make money, basically.
Yeah. There was a tweet someone put out that was like, you know, all the best founders I know are most successful people, like, read all the time and all of that. And I'm like, that is such a luxury. I just worked my butt off, but I learned how different companies work. And I was like also running a boutique for a woman in New Paltz, and I was in college. So like, I learned how you go to trade shows and like procure stuff for the stores and the markups on jewelry and clothes and that kind of stuff. And then marketing. And then at the bakery also, that was a grueling job. Like
really?
It's grueling. You're next to an oven.
You're baking, right? Yeah.
Literally. Okay. Yeah. I was making challah bread for the French toast at the bistro that's downtown. There's only one. It's a line out of the door on the weekends with college students, all of their muffins, cakes, pies, like the basics. And then in the evening and weekends, I worked for a legitimate pastry chef who made wedding cakes and things like that. I was her assistant. And then I would cater these events. And so I just did everything. Like, I worked at the gym, like the front desk. Like, I was like, whatever job I need to work to make money. One was like $8 an hour. The other was $10 an hour. And I just tried to work as much as I could. The school's a little, not that anyone's watching, but like, I wasn't always like vocal about it because they say you're not supposed to work, I think, more than like 8 or 10 hours a week if you're a college student. I couldn't do that. So I was consistently like just doing whatever I could.
What was the biggest thing that you kind of learned from all of that, just the college experience?
Maybe there's a lot, right? Like, my first car had a car payment. You know, like, you're paying all these yourself. You're like figuring out your own utilities. Like, it is like basic living stuff, like moved off campus. I think you learn a lot through like relationships you have, like boyfriends that you have in school. Like, literally all the choices are on you. I was never a big drinker. I got involved with that when I was really young just because of where I grew up. Like, I think I smoked weed at 11 years old, like for the first time.
Wow, that's pretty
so
young.
Like, that's insane. And I was like exposed to drinking at like 12. And so I think at a really young age, I know I did not like that. Never have. I love wine, but like Other than that, I've never been someone that's like, I've got to close the club. Like, I love to party. It's just not me. I will show up and then leave at 11. But like, it's just so thankfully that's never me. But you learn a lot of that and about other people and their intentions and stuff. So maybe more of like the human component of all the friendships and then like all the like just discipline around running. Honestly, I think I learned more from running. Running is extremely hard. Like you're running 80 miles a week and everything matters, your sleep, your food, just like all of the discipline that it took to show up every day, you know, never missing practice. Same with class. A lot of it's discipline. Like, do you have it or you don't? I had roommates that never went to class. They never had any motivation. They went out all night long. And that's great. But I was never that person. And so I just, it was in my blood, I guess, from when I was little.
You had to figure things out and you almost couldn't fuck up because you didn't have that luxury.
There was no not showing up for me.
Yeah.
Like I didn't, that wasn't even a thought. Like even if my leg was broken, I would still probably have showed up.
To
like,
run.
You just,
you just would have gone.
Or even to work, I would have been like, I'm here. Like I've just, even if I was sick, it's like, you just have to do it.
Maybe we don't do that post-COVID now anymore.
No. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to kill anyone.
Your first job out of college, I remember you also posted this thing about a text where somebody like, they went to bat for you. Was this that first post-college job?
No, second-ish. So,
okay, so how did you, what happened after college? You went to Spain?
So I went to Spain. Okay. So before I graduated college, I was connected with a pro triathlete whose husband, who is the person I posted the text about. So I got to know this family really well because she was a really great runner and none of the girls, it was a D3 school. No one cared about running in the team as much as me. Like I really wanted to do well, but for other people, they're like, Nicole, it's D3, chill. We're not a D1 school.
Like you're not going pro.
Yes. Like, so
you're going to go be an accountant after you graduate or something.
Like. So all the girls were like, God, she just is such a try hard, like runs so much and like does so, you know, but the most of the girls didn't care. So then, so I ended up training with her and getting to know her and John, her husband, really well. And he was running a big division at City. Delightful couple, like family. So I'd still known them, kept in touch. And then I went to study abroad to follow a boyfriend at the time. Great guy. And he had just done a year in Spain teaching English and he wanted to do another one. He graduated before me. So he was like, why don't you come out and do this for a year? And so I remember that entire summer leading up to it, I left in like September. I had to bake my butt off. I had no savings. I was literally baking like I was 15 hours a day. And I transitioned to one of the pastry chef look place because they paid me $15 an hour. So I remember the entire summer, I saved up like $3,500 and I go to Spain with that. And we get there and we're working through the Spanish government and the economy is 2013 was like in hell. And so the government could not pay us for 3 or 4 months.
Wow.
And so I burned through the 35 between getting, signing a lease and getting an apartment and like living there for the first 3 or 4 months. I had no money.
Did you get back paid for those 3 or 4 months?
Yes, we initially did. I think in January or February.
Okay.
But I was in a really hard place. And so in that time I had to get creative. So one of the teachers at the language school I was teaching at knew I baked. And so one day, I'm not kidding, she was like, Nicole, she couldn't afford to pay me, like help me. But she said, she in her car, she had all of these baking supplies. And she said, I'm going to give these to you. And then she drove me after class to her best friend's hostel. And she had a bar outside. And she said, I need baked goods. I'd like to buy them from you. What can you bake for me? And what's the price? And I was like totally taken apart. So she basically walked me into a job and brought me all the supplies and said, if you'll bake, we can find you money to like eat food. I didn't even have a dollar. I had nothing. I couldn't buy a coffee. I couldn't afford the bus. Like, and so I remember and I don't speak any Spanish. And this woman was like translating for us. I literally said to her, just like, pay me whatever you think is fair. And she said, that's not how businesses work. She goes, you go home, you come up with a business plan, you come back. And
so who was this person? Was just a random person or
the,
what was
the woman? So there was at the language school that I was teaching at, there was another teacher that is Spanish teaching English as well. So she's a local and her name's Toya and her and I became very good friends. And so she said one day she just showed up and she knew I like was needed to, I was trying to teach private English classes. I was trying to figure that out.
And then this other person was that you were selling.
And so Toya, her best friend, ran a hostel. So she said, I'm going to take you to my best friend's business. And she needs pastries.
To just have at the hostel.
Yes.
Okay.
To sell at the bar for snacks.
Okay.
So like she wanted muffins and cookies and American stuff. I think they honestly threw me a freaking bone, but like they made me work for it. She was like, go come up with a plan. And like, what can you bake for me? And can you drop them off every Friday? I need enough for like 4 days. And so I would make $50 a week, a weekend, but I would bake all of Wednesday night, Thursday night. I would drop everything off on Friday on my bike. So I would bike all this stuff. And then I would get paid anywhere from like 40 to 50 euro. And that was enough for me to take the bus and to pay for like very minimal groceries. and then the stuff I needed, you know, for the next week. And so that was my first company. And I mean, it was working, but definitely not scalable. And like, it was under the table because I didn't have any of the appropriate licenses to be doing that. But I definitely learned a ton from that experience because I was freaking poor. Like, that was the poorest I've ever been.
Really? Okay. Yeah. And then you moved back. Maybe don't have to get into all the details. Yeah. Sounds like you're not dating the boyfriend anymore.
No, I sort of left him there. We had a year to go and I was like, no, I mean, he's awesome. I was just like, I can't do it. You know, so at 6 months, I left early. I borrowed money from a friend for a flight back. And then, and this will probably lead into some of the venture stuff. And so I got a one-way plane ticket, came back. One of my really good friends from college, his dad ran a wholesale towel distributor in Brooklyn. And he was like, I'll give you a sales job basically as soon as you land. So it was like 35K base. I slept on his couch. He's awesome. I had nowhere to go. And he's like, I'll help you get on your feet. And he did. After that, I did this nonprofit thing in New York and was kind of making like incrementally like 10 grand more a year for like 2 years.
And when you're in that mode, like I remember when I was in college, I did 7 different internships and basically just each one, I'd go from $9 an hour to 10 to
literally,
12
yes.
18. I remember the first time I was making $20 an hour, I was like, holy shit, I'm making so much money. Right? That's what I thought at the time.
It's so much money. Even
it's like, life-changing.
I still think that the first time I made $50,000 a year is the wealthiest I've ever been because it was the first time that I could eat out like once a week and not worry. And to me, that was like huge. Like I can go to a nice restaurant once a week. And like, I thought I'd made it in my life. Like I was like, this is it.
Growing up, we'd go to the food pantry at the church. And I remember walking in there and there'd be like Fruit Loops, Frosted Flakes, Oreos, all this like awesome food that we never got to have. When I finally was making money again, when I like got my first job after college, I think it was 40 or 42K a year. It was like, I have so much money.
You know, fast forwarding, leaning on someone that I knew, John, the wife I trained with running. Yep. And I grew up in, you know, the projects like in affordable housing. And so I wanted to know how it was financed. So that was always interesting to me. Mm-hmm. So I had applied for a job at City Community Capital, which does like lending and affordable housing all over the country for city. And I applied to be an analyst. And so I pinged John and I just said, I would love to work there. And I don't think at the time I realized it was his group at City because City's really big.
Oh, you did? Okay.
So I don't even think I realized. So I applied without him and he basically was like, I'm not getting you this job, but I can like I can refer you, but like, I'm not going to get it for you, but I can prep you and teach you everything you need to know for the interview. But like, you know, or yeah, whatever.
He was on his team though. Doesn't he have autonomy over that?
No, they kept up another managing director had to be part of the process. Like he removed himself. He also, it was interesting. He actually told me I'm not good at hiring. Like I'm not a good picker. He was like, I just am not. He said that. And he's like the leader of this group, but he's like, I have to make other people make the final decision. Like I meet them, give my feedback, but he's like, I don't think I'm the best at like pulling the trigger. And so I end up, that was insane. I ended up getting the job. And then a year later, you get your bonus as an analyst. And I remember getting $20,000. And they call me into a room and they tell you on the phone. And I remember there was a glass wall. I'm in the managing director's office talking to the managing director in New York. So I'm alone. Yep.
Are you in SF?
I'm in SF.
Okay.
And there's like glass windows and I can see all of like the underwriters and everybody else on the team. And I was like on the deal team. And I remember saying to me through the phone, like, don't react or like, don't freak out. But he's like, he literally said to me, welcome to the 1%. And he was like, no one will ever, you know, few people will have these opportunities. And a lot of people on the team, the underwriting team, no one has like, no one's going to get this bonus except you and like 3 other analysts. Hmm. And so he was like, here's your first one. And they're only going to get bigger. And like, we're going to, you know, you're going to expect $20,000 in your bank account. And I was shocked. That was so much money to me.
That was like as much money as you'd made in your whole life.
Literally.
Basically.
And it was, I felt dirty. Like I was like, that is insane. Like, and I mean, I was making, I think 80 or 85K base. And in SF, it actually doesn't go that far. I had 5 roommates. So I was like, this is not it. It was, I remember paying $1,500 for rent and a 5-bedroom with 1 bathroom when I got to SF.
Wow.
One bathroom.
Was it 5 women in the
house?
Yes. That's
so you would hope that you woke up early enough to get first to the shower, first to the bathroom, get out.
You wake up last, you're leaving for work.
I remember literally having to pee so bad every morning. And be like, oh my God, how long do I have to wait? Like every morning, the girls were great. So I get the bonus and I'm like, holy crap. And so I text John and that's when I posted on Twitter. And I think that's probably my most liked tweet ever. And just said, like, he essentially in summary said, just take it and be happy. And he was like, I've learned that you can look at life in a number of ways. Like there's always the haves and the have nots. And there's always, the world isn't fair. And he's like, I've just learned that you have to take it and you have to be happy. And what's interesting is I actually, a couple of years ago on his birthday, sent the screenshot text back to him.
Okay.
And he responded and he said, I really needed to hear that. Like his own advice. Like he's like, I really needed like to hear this basically from myself. So it was cool.
That's awesome. And then I think I'm just remembering your LinkedIn. I haven't looked at it in 2 years, but
it's not impressive, but
well, so then what did you, is that when you worked at, I think, was it one
blend.
Okay.
So my whole, this is like when the tech and VC stuff starts. So
how'd that happen? You went from banker, special projects, financing,
yes,
you know, living the high life, Wall Street bonuses,
yes,
to startup.
So the culture at Citi sucked. So I was like chained to my desk for 14 to 16 hours. I'm living in SF where everyone works in tech and everyone's having their rooftop parties and their events and there was always something going on. And affordable housing, especially on the West Coast, it was crazy. So there were always deals to work on. There was always stuff to do. The work was awesome. The culture sucked. No free coffee, no nothing. I remember if I left to get coffee, there's like the chat with Microsoft, like Link or whatever. And like
Teams or Link at the time.
And I remember my boss being like, you've been idle for 7 minutes. Like, where did you go? Even if I left to go get coffee, someone would be like, where were you?
It's like, that's horrible. Coffee so I can keep working.
I'm in the bathroom. Like, I don't, you know, like I'm dying. I don't know. And so I remember just being like, this stinks. So after a year, I was recruited by what became my first startup called Blend. Blend went public in 2021. And
what did Blend do again?
So Blend is like enterprise mortgage software, point of sale software for anyone that lends mortgages. So if you go to wellsfargo.com right now and you hit apply for a mortgage online, they power that whole experience.
Interesting.
So it's white labeled. But they have Wells Fargo, US Bank, some really big logos, and they're just the entire digital point of sale so that people can finally get mortgages or at least apply for them online. And we were the only ones really doing that, a few small competitors.
Yep.
And Nima, the CEO and co-founder, him and I were kind of silly enough to think, so their issue was they were a bunch of brilliant CS grads from, you know, Carnegie Mellon, Stanford, but they're trying to sell to executives at banks and they never worked at a bank. They all came from Palantir. Okay. And so they're like, okay, so you're here trying to do what for us and you've never worked at a bank and no one at your company has ever worked at a bank before. So they were actively looking for people who could have the bank logo on their resume and like come into these meetings and say, I know anything about originations. What's comical is that affordable housing originations and mortgages are completely fucking different.
Yeah.
So I'm being like, I don't even know how mortgages are underwritten.
Like 2 years there. Like you're not an expert.
I have no idea. So I just rolled up my sleeves and honestly, like I am so meant. I was like, I am meant for startups. This is it. Like I love ambiguity. I love chaos. I hate structure, which is not surprising given my background, my life. And so it was perfect for me. And so Nima had formed the office of the CEO and I was on special projects, which basically meant, can you do everything that I throw your way?
You were kind of like chief of staff, I guess.
Sort of felt like just leading strategy a bit. Like it was like, hey, there's a joint venture to go build this insane business with another mortgage company. Can you go fly to Charlotte and figure out if that makes sense for us? There were M&A opportunities. Like we were looking at acquiring like a credit reseller. So I was on the road figuring that out. It was like, I was kind of his behind the scenes, like another him-ish, just on the road wise, never like the true company facing CEO type, but got to be exposed to raising a ton of capital. We raised a few hundred million when I was there. And so that was the ride of a lifetime for me. Like I remember we had a Wall Street Journal exclusive and the roof blew off in 2017 in terms of we like deployed 70 banks in a quarter. I mean, it was like true high growth. And I mean, paying for that now, I think the market cap's like 250 million since it went public, but a lot of lessons learned. I remember Nima passing out the book Blitzscaling, which now I want to burn. That was the worst strategy like ever.
No. Well, financial services, sometimes if you grow too fast.
It was just like the whole kind of peak. We could, so we did. And I think it IPO'd at around 4 billion, but again, it's down to 250 million right now. And mortgages are effed.
You have like the tech market just broadly pulling back, but then also interest rates just completely destroyed the mortgage business.
It's really tough.
They're still alive. People are still getting mortgages.
I think now is the time to build if you're early stage in it, like in and around mortgages, like especially if it's infrastructure.
Interesting. Why is that?
I have a plug for one of my companies, I guess. But
is this the Vesta?
Yes, okay. Vesta. So an amazing team and also one of my best friends, Mike and Devin.
This
left.
Is your first ever angel check. If I'm
Yes. So some insider baseball, I guess, because I know the space well and I knew the guys well. I angel invested at the seed, the first money in, and then Andreessen did the A, and then I came in with fund one in the A. And so it's also a fund investment and they're building a loan origination system. I won't bore anyone with what it is, but I think it's a huge opportunity and they're the right team. It'll just be a very long journey, but definitely a public company at some point and a great business. But that's like the kind of, if you're building the system of record, you ask anyone, any bank that does mortgages, if they like their LOS and they'll say, I hate it, every single one. So
was Blend an LOS or it was just online
POS.
Point of sale?
Okay. So just online point. So Blend is, it was tough for Blend because they essentially, in order to integrate with the two big LOSs on the market.
What's an LOS?
Loan origination system.
Okay.
AKA system of record.
So this is like the back end and then point of sale. Blend was the front end. Vesta is the back end.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's where every record, all the history on every deal, all of the credit data, everything lives on your, on you, like as a consumer getting a mortgage.
Okay. What's the better business, you think, back in
an LOS for sure. This is Vesta.
So this is Vesta, yeah. Right?
Okay. You want a meaty, high barrier to entry, very sticky, big long-term contracts. Mm-hmm. And that is not necessarily Blend. I think Blend, it definitely the best product in the market, but in terms of barrier to entry,
it's just a point of sale system.
It's an automated application with some data connectivity. They've since built much more broadly, but at the time we were getting to market, that was all the product was. Mm-hmm. Now they go through all the consumer products. They can help you apply for an auto loan online. They can do HELOCs. They can do more than that. But again, it's all 4 inches deep. And so it's a little bit tougher and they're tied to closed mortgages or loans. And so like, you actually have to get to the point where the deal closes before they get paid. So it's not like any activity on the platform, they're getting paid for it. You know, it's very contingent upon.
So it's basically like leads that convert and it's like transactional, a lot of fluctuation versus Vesta. If it's a system of record, it's more of like how many loans are on the book and it just slowly stacks up over time.
Yes.
Okay.
So you back into your minimums. It's an ARR business, but you back into the minimums based on average volumes. And then there's obviously overages that you'll get billed for, but you can have 3 to 5 year. These contracts are long. So they're like typically 5 year contracts. And if you're landing the biggest lender in the US, you're probably talking about a $5 to $8 million a year deal. So these are bigger deals and they're sticky. No one replaces their system of record often. And so it's hard to get them and definitely hard to rip them out. I think Blend is a little bit easier to compete with. Still think it's the best business for that, but definitely easier to compete with.
And then you did another fintech.
Luckiest you did three thing fintechs, ever. Right? I did. Yeah. Basically, one construction tech. So second company, and this will kind of, so I love the early stages. I was like, okay, when Blend got to Series E, we signed the term sheet, I left. I was like,
when did you join? Were you the third employee?
No.
You
said, or that was one. A different one? At one, I was in the, I think I was actually five. I think I was corrected recently. I think I was five. There were two engineers that snuck in. But
Because last night you said third, I think.
At one?
I thought I was third.
And then last night after dinner, I met with who's now one of my LPs, Brian, who is the founder.
Okay.
And he was like, I think you were fifth. And I was like,
I always like that argument of like, you know, there's the famous J. Cal on his interview about like, he was the third or fourth investor in Uber or something. Have you seen that?
No, I have not
it's
seen
so
that.
It's so awesome. It's just like a joke of like, was he the third? Was he the fourth?
I don't forget. Well, what happens is they hired the original team and then everyone kind of had offers letters out. And so I think like, I thought because I was like start, I don't know, whatever, yeah, but who cares? It was just as hard if I was three or five. I mean, we signed the term sheet for the Series E and we were so corporate big at that point. Like I was like, oh wow. Like everyone kept saying like 2 more years to IPO. And I was like, this is a big business now. Like,
corporation, how many employees?
Over 500. I hated it. Oh, I was like, no, like so sticky and so many like executives. And I was like, oh, this is when things slow down. I was like a big believer at the time in these consumer neobanks. I think Chime was really? Barely a unicorn at the time.
This was like 2017?
Early 2019.
Early 2019.
So I was at Blend for 2 years, but we scaled from around like 50-ish to 500 in those 2 years. And then I was actually considering working at Chime and I'd applied there. And then I got approached by an old coworker who was going to help start a consumer neobank called One Finance. At the time, it was called Safecorp, which was a holding company.
That's a bad name. I'm glad they
horrible.
Rebranded.
It was horrible. Oh, Bill. So Bill Harris, whose idea it was, he was actually on the founding team of PayPal with Elon. He was the first CEO. And he ended up coming up with the idea. And he was like, he had his whole career, he was 63 when we started One, but really wanted to name something Safecorp. Was like, is this the one? Is
like
this
Elon the one?
And it's like, literally, like, it was maybe, like, no, this is not it. Like, this is like, you say safe and it's a bank. And they're like, no, like, it's not, it can't be safe. So we built it from scratch. All of it was like, we didn't use a banking service provider. At the time, there was only Synapse. And we were using like a new cloud native core banking system called Finxact, which was another startup. But we really, really built it all essentially in-house and didn't kind of do the fast path, which was like banking as a service. You also don't really own your accounts. And so
you're saying with banking as a service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then like, you don't know the sponsor bank. And so like, are the accounts even yours if you move? Yeah. Like there's all these things, even founders now, and they pitch me these companies. I'm like, do you know how this works? Like, do you know what, like what's going on here? And so we build that. Consumer is a beast, my first consumer company. And then after just over a year and a half, once we raised a Series A, which there's, that's a whole other podcast episode. That was a grind.
What year was this you raised?
This was in 2019. I think I probably need 5 years to tell the story, but like raising the A was literally one of the hardest things I've done in my career.
Really? What did you learn from it?
One of the founders self-funded it with like the first $9 million. And but because there was $9 million to play with, because he had the capital, we were all frankly way overpaid. He was very generous. Mm. But then when you get to 40 people and you have $1 million in burn and you're a seed stage company, that's crazy. So we went out to raise the A. Our burn was really high. We had the best
million
people
per month.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we were, it was not cheap. We did try to do everything right. And we had hired the chief product officer of N26 out in Europe. That was like one of the best neobanks to come to the US and run product. Like, we sort of went way upstream, had a mix of like executives and like really expensive hires that knew what they were doing. The acquisition worked out, and I think it was largely because of that, but there was a lot of house cleaning. Like, we weren't really as lean as we should have been. Like, I learned we probably did all that wrong. And then when you have a cap table where you raise a lot of money and you have no revenue and like 1,000 customers raising an A, VCs are like, I'm sorry, what?
That would have flown in 21 though. You just show them a wait list.
And I don't even know if we had that, but we were not in a place. So we took a ton of dilution at the A. It was really hard to get it done. And also we were another neobank at that point. And so it was hard to show how we were different. I think it was definitely different.
What was the differentiation again in your mind?
Well, the product was unique in that we essentially attached a credit line to your debit account. And so we would essentially be underwriting you based on your spend that we would see and then float you at like zero APR for the first month, like how a credit card works. Like, we would essentially float you. It was like a credit card attached to a debit account. And so you could toggle on and off into that. And then what was cool is there's a concept of pockets where in the app, if you and I had a shared pocket and we're at dinner together, right before I give them the card to go swipe it, I just point the pocket at our shared account versus my other one. And you get rid of this fat wallet problem. You essentially have one account, like one card, but it's linked to several pockets. So one could be me and you. Okay. Another could be... If we both had a one account, we could open up shared pockets for you and your buddies have a baseball club that you do events for. I don't even know. And then anytime, again, one single card, it could point at these different accounts when you toggle it through the app. And so people actually loved it. It was a little bit hard to message how the fuck it worked because it shouldn't take me 2 minutes to explain that to you. You know, Walmart ended up buying it for a very large amount of money after 3 years of work because we owned our accounts. Like, we owned the stack. The product was working. Our NPS score was high. Simple shutting down helped us a lot. We acquired like over 100,000 users overnight when they shut down. Mm-hmm. Everyone needed a new home and people love Simple.
It was Simple, similar neobank.
Like, yes, similar neobank. It had a cult following. I'd never used it, but it was like a very hardcore cult following for people who did. So they were like, what's the alternative? There was a big Reddit thread and everyone was like, one. So that really helped us get our first 100,000 customers.
Oh, so you didn't even acquire Simple.
We acquired all the Reddit. Everyone was like, Simple has said, hey, we're shutting down in like a month or something. Go find an alternative bank. And so people were like, what do we do? We want something with this type of flexibility. We want a mobile app. We want, you know, whatever. And so we inherited all these users.
Wow.
Which was very helpful.
Reddit is really interesting for consumer fintech customer acquisition, good and bad. I mean, like, if you go on r/personal finance or like there's credit card hacking, the term, but there are communities of millions of people that just sign up for new accounts and get, I feel like you just got to be careful how you design your system to not lose and make sure you're getting the right kind of customers. But there's a lot of people that are always.
So I was in charge of getting our first 5,000 customers before this happened because the board was like, you guys need to get moving. Like, we had, and I remember creating this and I was desperate and COVID had hit. So our launch was going to be to do right when we announced in March and we went live out of beta was March of 2020. We were in the Wall Street Journal on literally like March 13th. And that was when the world fell apart.
Wow.
So we were going to go to college campuses, do a lot of boots on the ground customer acquisition. None.
Wow.
So Brian was like, you better get creative because this is on Unicole. Cause I was like head of strategy, whatever. And I was like, oh shit. So I actually, crazy story. I created this like ambassador program and we were giving $75 per every time you referred someone and they funded their account, then we would give you $75.
That is big.
Big. And we'd cap it at 5 people.
Okay.
Well, then I was like, Brian, why don't I pitch the team? And I was like, why don't we lift it? And for our super ambassadors, we can just call them that. We'll make it unlimited for 30 days. So they can get paid for as many people as they can get to do that as possible in a month. Of course, someone leaks it on Reddit. And I wake up one morning amid all the signups feeding through Slack. And I'm going on a run. It's in SF. And I'm doing like this Hawk Hill run. And I remember it's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I opened that Slack channel before the run. And there was like thousands of them. And I was like, Slack is broken today. And Slack's broken. We usually see like 5 a day. And so I go for the run and Brian calls me 4 times. And I'm like, who died? Like, what is going on? I finally answered like the top of Hawk Hill. And I was like, what's going on? And he's like, did you see Slack? I'm like, yeah, it's broken. And he's like, no, Nicole, somebody leaked the referral code and it's unlimited on Reddit. And we had, I think it was was 25,000 signups in 12 hours.
Wow.
A lot, 30% was fraud. People, like, you go see their ID that they take a photo of, and it'd be like some piece of paper from like signing in at a building. And like it would be like the craziest, like a lot of them would default to like manual review because it was like a ton of fraud. But like, still, I was like, it was great for us because we were able to stress test all of our fraud stops, like all of our KYC, everything, which was great.
Were you able to catch the bad customers and keep the good ones?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And then we had to pay some people some money for referrals. So I knew the person, you could back into like whose code it was and who did it. And they were like, oh, our bad. We were actually grateful. So we didn't pay them the like thousands of dollars you would have owed them, but we like met them in the middle. I can't remember what we paid them, but we couldn't honor like 25,000 times $75. So yeah. It was crazy.
So you even got a deal then on all the customers.
Yes.
Too.
So again, so much of this is like just luck and trying stuff. It's like, I've seen you be smart about it and like data driven, but like so much of building companies is just like trying everything
just doing things,
you can.
Iterating. Yeah.
Yes. And then iterating and like not trying to burn the house down money wise while you're doing it, especially in consumer.
Did you go to Built before or after the acquisition?
I went to Built before, but then I got in touch. I was connected with Omer, who now runs it, and through a VC at Index. And they was like, you should talk to Omer. He's trying to figure out, Walmart and Ribbit pulled together $1 billion to do a joint venture. And they, you know, want to build the next Ant Financial. And so they wanted to acquire the infrastructure. And so they talked to everybody. When I tell you every neobank, they looked at every single one. Hmm. And I've told Omer, I met him before he really got moving. He wanted advice on the market. And at first I was like, buy a bank as a service provider. And then I was like, okay, I see what you're trying to do. I go, why don't you look at one? Never thought in a million years you'd do it. Get a call from him like a month or two later. I end up coming to New York to see him. And he's like, I'm going to let you in on, like, basically we're digging in on one. And I'd love your help thinking about a few parts of the business. And then I'll let you know we're quick with M&A in like 6 weeks if it's happening. And then I wake up on like January 29th of last year to news, a Wall Street Journal exclusive, that one was acquired by Walmart and they have a new bank. And then Omer called me and just said, thank you so much. I couldn't tell you before it was announced, but like we did the deal. It was a huge deal. I can't really disclose the amount, but it was huge. And it was a huge payday for me personally. And I was like, I can afford this VC thing now because I had a $5 million fund at the time. So I had, so one is acquired. I have an influx of capital, which was like an absolute gift. I didn't make any money on Blend because I never sold. And now it's like $1.20, but also lessons there. And then Built is an amazing business, did 2 years in construction and vertical SaaS and an absolute dynamite. It's still a private company based in Nashville. And so I start angel investing with my own capital in 2020. Where am I at that point? I was at Built. Yep. And then about 6 months into it, maybe, or eight, I get a call from a VC and he says, you have great deal flow. The companies you've chosen to work early at are awesome. We have a fund of funds. Can we give you capital? I had never heard of a fund. I was like, what is a fund? Is this a scout thing? Like, what is it? So long story short.
And you said, you're like, I don't want to be a scout.
Yeah. I was like, I have to scout. Yeah. I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, and so I end up raising, at first it's going to be $1 million fund. I capped it at five. This is peak 21. I was 100% someone that was like, could take advantage of a very liquid market. Everyone was throwing money around. And I was able to raise $5 million in a month off of an email. Mm-hmm. So
did you have a deck?
No.
Small enough. I feel like that bet on just Nicole at that point in time probably didn't need to be a deck.
Yes. And these were friendly. So I learned a lot, which we could do a whole other session on. I fell on my face for fun too, because I really didn't understand. Like everyone was friendly in the first one. I had 31 or 32 LPs in fund one, and I knew almost everyone, except Sendana, who came in. I had met them, but they came in for $1 million, which is a very small check for them. They anchored it, co-anchored with the buyers, Chad and Blake Byers. Chad runs Sousa Ventures. Yep. They have been tremendous for me in my career in venture. And I closed it at five. And it definitely had a skewed view of raising funds. I was like, oh, this is easy.
You just thought, I send emails and people give me $1 million. Literally. Yeah.
And that should not be the case. And it was not the case for fund two. So I ended up leaving Built in March of 22, so a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And went at it full time. So started calling it Wishoff Ventures, and then went out to raise a $20 million fund, which I closed in Q4 of last year. And that was extremely hard. So I raised, I think, about 50% of it in about 2 or 3 months from existing folks that kind of re-upped. Sendana came in for $4 million. And then I had to go meet new people. And I did not realize that they need to know you forever. And so I kind of thought it'd be the same one call close, $1 million here, $1 million there, we'll get there. And I was very humbled with fund two. I think you and I met during that, where I was like, this is not easy. The market totally changed and it was a grind. So I feel very fortunate that I had closed 20. I think it took about 7 months. And here we are doing this damn crazy thing. But it's been nuts, you know, it's been totally crazy.
So how should somebody approach raising their first fund? It's just you have to meet people ahead of time. You have to build trust. You have to build a track record of some kind of getting things done or investing. What advice would you have for somebody doing their first fund?
Start building your network. If they're, especially in a place like New York, even the event we were at last night, show up. There's so many free events. Show up, start meeting people and start helping them. So if you meet other VCs or other angels, like share, say, hey, there's a company I saw that was interesting or I read about it or know about them already before and just be like, hey, you've done a few deals. I'm really interested in learning more and start asking questions, start learning and start sharing deals or talking about deals with people. And then similarly with LPs, the thing is your network is everything. So I don't think I get cold DMs from LPs, but largely raising fund too, it's warm intros. So you're relying on other people that you have some relationship with. Maybe you've looked at a deal together. Like you're not going to introduce me to just anyone just meeting me of your LPs. You're going to be like, Nicole, those are really important relationships to me. I can't just throw you over the fence to them and I don't even know you. And so a lot of it is like, get in the mix, get in the culture, start having conversations and just showing up where you can and trying to help people because they'll help you in return. I would say would be like, get as close to like the nucleus of what's going on that you can.
So then in terms of how you got those introductions to LPs, what would you say the breakdown just in terms of percentages of like, who did you get those introductions from?
I didn't realize how many family offices there are or any of that. Everyone I know seems to know people with a lot of money and I didn't know that either. And so a lot of my founders were like, I feel like every existing LPs, other VCs, founders, everyone knew at least, I feel like everyone introduced me on average to three people. I tracked a lot of this. Existing LPs introduced me, like Lee Fixel introduced me to like three of his friends, you know, and then they came in or one of them did not, two of them did. And then their kind of flywheel started. I never really asked. People were very gracious. Like, hey, Nicole, are you still raising? Like there's a few people that are looking for great managers that are doing fintechy stuff and early stage.
This was fund one or fund two?
Fund two, sorry.
Oh, this fund two.
Fund one, I kind of knew. It was like, I knew folks at Bain, they had a fund of funds, Foundation Capital, Thrive. They came in. Lee came in from Addition.
And Lee was, I see on the board of Built.
Yes.
Okay.
So I met him there. He is the best. Between him and Chad Byers, I would not probably be here in venture. Yeah. Okay. They have been just absolutely the most tremendous support systems, really big advocates for me, and honestly there to answer all of my dumb questions about how in the heck I got to do this job.
I've heard you say you wish you didn't name it after yourself. Is that still?
Now that we're here, we're here.
Yeah.
This is going, I've never, you know, I don't know that I've really said this out loud, but maybe to my husband, like I think the Wyshoff name is like tied to so much poverty and like just shit. There's no one in the family that's like, you know, really done anything or like kind of pulled the family like out of poverty. And like in a part of me, I feel like this is something a dude would say, but like, I want to bring something better to the name. And so sometimes I kind of thought about this after the fact, you know, I originally was Wyshoff Ventures because I was lazy and I was like, who cares what it's called? It's just, you know,
who knows if I'll even do this again?
I might not like this. Yes.
I want to be a VC.
Yeah. And then, you know, as I got thinking about it, I was like, how cool would it be for people to associate Wyshoff with something amazing?
Yeah.
And so, and then I got excited and I was like, that would be so cool. My nieces and nephews, like maybe there's an opportunity for, you know, so I think that's been something that, and I did get married and his last name is way cooler. It's Steele. And so I need to figure that out. It's so cool.
Steele Ventures is pretty cool.
It's so cool.
Steele Capital.
So I was like, I was looking around. I think he took Steele Capital, but I think the big thing was if I bring people in another partner, I want it to feel like there's a team dynamic and not just like, you know, my name on a big building or something someday, but maybe it doesn't matter. So I go back and forth. But looking out, look, ultimately, as I do this every day, I realize more and more that there's a bigger opportunity to truly co-lead and lead these rounds and to make an impact. There is not a household name pre-seed and seed. There are, I think, 3,500 pre-seed and seed stage funds just in the US, and I don't even know who they are. And that is, I think, a huge problem for them. Like if you have a brand or if you have a company, you should be, in my opinion, out there every day talking about it.
Yeah.
And especially at pre-seed and seed, I say that because you can't find the founders yet normally. There is no market.
You need inbound.
You need them to find you. They are off the grid. They're thinking about their company. They might still be somewhere else. It's super quiet.
Yep.
And so you have to be in a position. At growth, it's different. There's a billion market maps. You know all the companies that have raised money and you can just go source that way. But in our world, I've got to be out there so people can find me. And they do. But
you need the founder, their friend, one of your friends, like one of like.
Sometimes they're family members. Like I'm doing a deal right now and the brother had pinged me separately. And I was like, wait, he's like, you just invested in my brother. I'm like, literally last week. I'm like, I did. He's like, I've been following you for like 2 years.
That's
so awesome. Yeah. Stuff like that, which you get too, I think, just with the social stuff.
I get a questioned a lot, like, why don't you do tons of outbound? Are you not like data driven? I mean, the pretty common pitch is like, we're so data driven. We pull in all these sources. Like there's an SEC filing. We're on it. I'm like, you're too late. I mean, I'm not going to compete with that. I just 100%. Need them. They're still working at whatever company. They're thinking about starting something new. That's the only advantage we have against you know, $1 billion in AUM. So
yes, they have a different luxury. You know, it's a totally different ballgame. And yeah. So I'll continue to do that. And I want people to associate early stage venture with us. And yeah. So if we can do that through TikTok and Twitter and all of that, then that's yeah. amazing.
You told a story last night, the third tier VC. Can you just go through that? Take us behind the scenes of what happened.
I, of course, like many people in venture, probably look up to Keith Urboy, Founders Fund. He is obviously an incredible investor and has had a fantastic career. And yeah. I love Founders Fund. I love their mission. I love everything about it. I tweeted back in March. I guess what was viewed as a jab because Miami is a sensitive topic on Twitter. And yep. I tweet that it's been exactly 2 years and I haven't met a single founder, you know, in Miami. And he responds and says, like pretty quickly after I posted it, that's because they're too busy succeeding to talk to a third tier VC. And I remember sitting on the couch in my living room and I just literally started bawling. Like I was like, oh my God, my husband's like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And it was the most hurtful thing I think anyone could have possibly said to me from his position. And, you know, I'm a board observer in a company with Founders Fund. I am in a few deals with them actually. And I adore a few people on their team that I know well. And Peter Thiel's an LP. And so I was like, wait, hang on. And I kind of commented back and just said, like, that's basically super hurtful. I'm sorry, you know, feel that way. I don't even know what I said. I was so upset. I had to like turn my phone off. Mm-hmm. He did delete it in 10 minutes. I think he was maybe, I don't know how or what happened there, but.
Yeah. I mean, I think Keith's just like, chirps back people. It's like yeah. sometimes it's kind of sarcastic.
Me. I will not let it yeah. crush me. You know, from my viewpoint, I thought here is someone that it would be amazing to be like, you know, Midas list, like really amazing at the craft of investing and how cool to be on the same list or associated with him. And I mm-hmm. thought, shit, everyone loves this guy. Like he's going to be like, this is going to crush my career. Like if he's basically telling me I'm a nobody, then I'm fucked, you know? Mm-hmm. And that actually was the opposite of what happened. So I had to turn my phone. I couldn't even look at it. I was honestly so upset about it. I was like, my career is over. The opposite happened. A lot of people reached out to me. A lot of billionaires reached out to me. And like, to be transparent, people don't like him. And I don't have an opinion. Like, I mean, he really hurt my feelings once, but like, I have to be an adult. And a lot of people were in my camp and they were like, he's a jerk. He always has been. Leave it alone. And then actually one of my billionaire LPs gave me the swag idea. He was like, you got to make some merch. So I lost my, like, I was so upset. So for 2 days, I was really embarrassed and people were reaching out in support, but I felt like a charity case. I'm like, this whole thing sucks because Sam Parin had a screenshot of it. He posted it and was like, Keith, you're a dick. And he came in my defense, but it made it so much worse because really, it was out there again. It was deleted. It was gone. Five people saw it, maybe 100, then thousands of people saw it and it was amplified. And I was just like, this sucks. And then he ended up, I mean, I never heard from him. Someone recently told me that like I should apologize to him because he was so embarrassed by how bullied, maybe beat up he got from it. And that like he won't forget. And like maybe Founder Some will never do a deal with me again, which I was like, what the fuck? I feel like this is gaslighting. Like what is going on here? Yeah. So I've since let it go, but that sucked. But it also actually really, really helped amplify the brand even more. And I did say this last night, but I did send him a coffee mug that just said Wishaw Ventures, like third tier VC in the mail to like Miami, just as like a playful jab. But shit happens. I don't argue on the internet. You know, yeah. people are going to suck. But yeah, that kind of, I think a lot of people know me now from that, for better yeah. or worse.
Yeah, I thought, I remember when it happened. I remember texting you and you're just like, I don't even know what's going on. Like this is...
I was the main character. You never yeah. want to be that. I was like, yeah. everyone in the world reached out to me. Literally, like I had a founder who was like, my brother in Europe is talking to me about this. I'm like, what? Wow. It was like the reach of it was crazy. Wow. But at the end of the day, look, people can be people. Maybe that's his brand. I don't hold anything against him. But I also want to kind of shed the third tier VC thing. I don't want to build a brand on the back of shit. You know, like I want it yeah. to be because we're doing great stuff.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of just rolling with the punches. I mean,
sold 450 sweatshirts. It was like absolutely nuts.
That's marketing. People are paying you to market.
It's my favorite thing in the world where I see really powerful people and they send me selfies that I don't even know on Twitter of them just wearing my sweatshirt in solidarity. I'm like, let's go.
That's awesome.
I feel bad. I know there was so much more in the venture stuff we didn't get to, but I really appreciate this. And hopefully people find some of this either helpful or interesting and hopefully not too boring. But
yeah, I think it was really interesting. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot about you from our conversations, but I learned even more. So this is a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
And thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, send this episode to your favorite emerging venture manager. If you don't want to miss future episodes, subscribe to my newsletter, The Split, in the show notes and get new ones right to your inbox. Thanks again to Nicole for coming on, and reach out to her or me if you're raising a pre-seed or seed round. And thanks again to SecureFrame and its automated compliance and security platform for supporting the show. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. We'll see you next time.